£10 Penalty. Written by Dick Francis and read by Tony Britton.
I sat on the back seat of the car for almost an hour, while the chauffeur drove at a slow pace through Sussex south of London, approaching finally the seaside spread of Brighton. He would answer none of my questions except to say that he was following instructions, and after a while I stopped asking. Short of jumping out and running free at any of the few traffic light stops, it seemed I was going to go wherever my father had ordained. And as I had no fear of him, I would, from long-conditioned habit, do what he asked. I thought chiefly, and in a mixture of rage and unhappiness, of the scene in Durridge's study, his words circling endlessly in memory, and not getting more bearable as time went by. The black car drifted past Regency townhouses and open-fronted souvenir shops, past old grandeur and new world commercialism, and sighed to a stop on the seafront, outside the main door of a large hotel of ancient French architectural pedigree, with bright beach towels drying on its decorative wrought-iron balconies. Porters appeared solicitously. The chauffeur climbed out of his seat and ceremoniously opened the door beside me, and thus prompted, I stood up into the sea air, hearing gulls crying and voices in the distance calling on the wet ebb-tide strand, smelling the salt on the wind, and unexpectedly feeling the lift of spirits of the sandcastle holidays of childhood. The chauffeur made me a small sketch of a bow, and pointed at the hotel's main door, and then, still without explaining, he returned to his driving seat, and at a convenient moment inserted himself into the flow of traffic and smoothly slid away. "Luggage, sir?" one of the porters suggested. He was barely older than myself. I shook my head. For luggage, I wore the clothes suitable for first lot August morning exercise with the Durridge string. Jodhpurs, jodhpur boots, short-sleeved sports shirt, and harlequin-printed lightweight zipped jacket, unzipped. I carried, by its chin-strap, my shiny blue helmet. With a conscious effort, I walked these inappropriate garments into the Grand Hotel, but I needn't have worried. The once formal lobby buzzed like a beehive with people looking normal in cut-off shorts, flip-flop sandals, and message-laden T-shirts. The composed woman at the reception desk gave my riding clothes an incurious but definite assessment, like a click on an identification parade, and answered my slightly hoarse inquiry. "Mr. George Juliard?" she repeated. "Who shall I say is asking for him?" "His son." She picked up a telephone receiver, pressed buttons, spoke, listened, gave me the news. "Please go up. Room 412. The lift is to your left." My father was standing in an open doorway as I walked down a passage to locate 412. I stopped as I approached him, and watched him inspect me, as he customarily did. From my dark curly hair, impervious to straightening by water, to my brown eyes, thin face, lean frame 5'11" or thereabouts of long legs to unpolished boots. Not in any way an impressive experience for an ambitious parent. "Ben," he said. He breathed down his nose, as if accepting a burden. "Come in." He tried hard always to be a good father, but gave no weight to my infrequent assurances that he succeeded. I was a child he hadn't wanted, the accidental consequence of his teenage infatuation with a woman biologically just old enough to be his own mother. On the day I went to Brighton, I was almost as old as he had been when he fathered me. Over the years, I'd gleaned the details. There'd been a hullabaloo in both extended families when they were told of the pregnancy, an even worse fuss, product of the times, when my mother refused an abortion, and a frosty turning of backs at the hasty and happy wedding.